All right, welcome to our session. We have a very interesting session planned for you with friends of NATOA and new colleagues here. We're going to be exploring a variety of ways in which local governments can interact more successfully with the government. Okay, with the government. Tell me when I've got it at the right height. Paul, you're the guinea pig here. You're the canary. Can you hear me okay? Okay, so that's what we need here. So let me jump right in and introduce our panel. First of all, let me start on our right with a dear friend, Chris Veen. In other years, he would be a host here in San Francisco. We all know him as the former CIO of the City and County of San Francisco. He is now the Deputy Chief Technology Officer for the U.S. government at the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and his area of responsibility is innovation in government. And to my immediate right is also an old friend of NATOA with whom many of you are familiar, Jessica Zaffolo. She is the Deputy Administrator of the Rural Utility Service of the Department of Agriculture, working with our dear friend Jonathan Adelstein, and she has an amazing area of multiple responsibilities, including the BIP program and various other loan and grant programs of RUS, and she's been working on smart grids and a variety of other activities. To my far left, we have Dina Shelter. She's the Associate Bureau Chief of the Wireless Competition Bureau. Wireline, excuse me. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. Dina has been with the FCC for about 15 years, has had some periods where she has been on consignment or loan to other organizations such as NTIA. She is going to be of particular interest to our group here today. She's the point person on right-of-way issues for the FCC's Wireline Bureau, and Dina will tell us as much as she can today about what the department is seeing, and we will certainly leave plenty of time for dialogue with the audience and Dina. To my immediate left is Sam Gill, who's a project director with Friedman Consulting. He has assisted foundations and nonprofits and elected officials and private sector entities on a variety of public communications issues. And in these times, we representatives of local government need all the support we can get in learning to communicate better with our many audiences. So Sam, welcome. Now, we're going to try to do this. We're going to spend about 3-4 minutes each talking about the areas in which we're involved. Some of you may not know what OSTP does or what Chris's role in OSTP is. And, so we'll talk a little bit about what we're doing. Then we're going to do Q&A, but we're going to try not to do Q&A the way it's ordinarily done, where we have only the moderator who's asking questions. We'd like to have a committee of the whole here, and each person participate in whatever question strikes you that you'd like to pose to any other member of our panel. We welcome your doing that. We'll also try to be interactive throughout, and let's get started. Dina, how about if we start with you?
Associate Bureau Chief in the Wireline Competition Bureau, and I've been in this role for almost a year now. And one thing I just want to wanted to say as to let you know of a conversation I had with my boss, Sharon Gillette, who used to be amongst the state folks and really has an appreciation for the issues that state and local communities face. When I talked to her about taking the job, what she said to me is, I want someone who's going to own rights-of-way issues, and almost more importantly, I want someone who's going to own facilitating a better relationship with the state and local governments. And that was really a recognition by Sharon and others in the Bureau and in the Commission that this relationship is very important. And, you know, while we have the same goals in many instances, we bring very different perspectives to this, and we think that everyone benefits from those perspectives. And we wanted it she wanted to make it a priority within our Bureau that relationship be taken care of. Over time, I know there's been issues with we had a local government group which is no longer in place, and we're waiting for the Intergovernmental Advisory Committee to be reconstituted. I know that expectation is that's going to be happening this fall. I'm just really here to talk about what we're doing on rights of way. What the Commission is focusing on right now, as you may know, is what we call our Broadband Acceleration Initiative. That is made up of several proceedings across different bureaus, but basically it's about getting networks built. It's focused on that aspect of broadband build-out, so it's pole attachments, it's wireless facility siting, it's rights-of-way issues. And as you all are well aware, we have an open NOI on that right now. The record closes next week, and we've, you know, looked through the 2,000-plus pages of comments. We really appreciate all the thoughtful and informative comments that state and locals and their representative associations, such as NATOA, filed in our proceeding, and we're reading them carefully. And I look forward to this discussion today.
Sam, please.
So I come to this issue with, in many ways, a lot less experience than a lot of the other folks on the panel. So first, I'd just like to thank everyone for inviting me to be on this. I'm very honored to participate. Among the work that I do at Friedman Consulting, I've worked on both national and local campaigns. And although being relatively new to the issue of community broadband, in particular municipal broadband, it's very clear to me that this is really potentially one of the great untapped, I think, political opportunities that we have in America right now. And I think I can talk a little bit as the panel goes on about why, but I think that first, it speaks to, I think, a lot of the aspirations that Americans feel like they're losing at this time, that this isn't a country that can get better. That a lot of the work that you are doing is the kind of work that can reaffirm people's faith that not only can we do better today, but we can have a much brighter tomorrow. But I also think that a lot of the realities of municipal broadband break down a lot of the divisions that you see dominating the national political picture. It's not a partisan issue. There's a lot of feet. I feel like the microphone is disagreeing with me with what I'm saying. It's a partisan microphone. But issues like partisanship, I also think that a lot of general dissatisfaction with government and government services at the national level is something that I think that municipal broadband also speaks to, that it's a way to show that government can work, that government can be innovative, and can also deliver more for taxpayer investment. So again, I'd love to talk about some of these issues more as the panel goes on, but that's the perspective that I hope to bring.
I assure you, you will have that opportunity. Jessica, please.
Thank you so much for having me join you all today, and it's a pleasure to be here in beautiful San Francisco. I must say that the weather in Washington is also very nice today, so I just actually came in about an hour ago, so Delta is always nice to me, but I'm being facetious. I wanted to thank you all on behalf of the Rural Utility Service for having us be part of this discussion. The RUS is a $65 billion infrastructure bank that provides loan and grant financing for rural infrastructure development and to facilitate public-private partnerships across local governments, tribal nations, and small community-based partnerships and business development to really facilitate next-generation infrastructure across rural America. Our portfolio covers Rural Electric. The agency started in 1935 under the Rural Electrification Administration. We became the RUS in the 1990s. Our investments in telecommunications started in 1949. and we have been providing low-cost capital to communities since then to build out facilities to the most rural, remote areas in the United States. We also provide loan grant financing for water infrastructure projects. And through the leadership in our administration, we're very engaged and very pleased to be part of the Recovery Act initiative through the Broadband Initiatives Program. The RUS has $3 billion in investments for about 300 projects across 46 states and one U.S. territory. We did 19 technical assistance awards, 14 of which went to tribal nations. So there's a very deep commitment on behalf of USDA Rural Development and the RUS in really meeting the infrastructure challenges that many of you all face, because we know that communities that are really struggling to access the capital markets, it is very difficult to do so now more than ever, and having a revenue opportunity to be able to leverage the core competencies of your community with resources that we can provide at RUS really meet these critical infrastructure needs. Other thing I wanted to mention is 2 weeks ago the agency put forth new regs pursuant to the 2008 Farm Bill that authorizes the RUS to establish an eligibility criteria within our existing infrastructure loan program to finance next generation interoperable integrated public safety broadband networks. And what this does is it enables local governments to utilize 911 fees as collateral. So we're really excited about this. And this opportunity is available today, and this is not new money. This is within the existing loan program. So I am very eager to talk to all of you about this and all the work that we're doing across the administration and with OSTP and really meeting these needs and doing so in creating infrastructure jobs across rural America.
And she just flew in from Washington, I flew in from New York. I think we're both flying somewhere tomorrow. United's not any better than Delta. I am working for an organization called the Office of Science and Technology Policy. It is part of what is called the Executive Office of the President. And the Executive Office of the President includes agencies like Office of Management and Budget, the Domestic Policy Council, the White House, and other agencies like OSTP. OSTP has traditionally been very heavy on science. It is the home of the science advisor to the president, and as such, advises on everything from climate to NASA, and very, very active involvement there. This administration took the additional step of adding a chief technology officer, Anish Chopra, to the mix. He's also an assistant to the president, so we are one of the few agencies that actually has two people that report directly to the president. And it really affords an interesting balance now of both technology and science policy direction coming out of the White House of the Executive Office of the President. Anish Chopra is the first, as I said, chief technology officer, and he likens his role to that of a new product development, whereas the CIO, Stephen Van Roekel, who just came in, is more about keeping the lights on. We're more about trying to think of new ways to use those lights. And it was very interesting to listen to the conversation earlier, because that is really what we're about, is how do we take both an infrastructure standpoint as well as the economic tools as well as innovation itself and really catapult the country moving forward and really, at this point, focus on job creation. So as Deputy Chief Technology Officer, I have a specific portfolio called Government Innovation. And really what that means is building on my experience in San Francisco, but my experience with other cities across the country and states, is really figuring out now what is working in this country when it comes to government in terms of changing and improving how we deliver our products and services. What is really happening across the country, and are there specific things that are common across states, locals, tribes, whatever it may be, when it comes to developing new and interesting products and services? And is there a way to extract all that and create a national strategy around innovation in government? And that's what I spend most of my time and no free time worrying about, really, is how do we scale what's working here in San Francisco or working in Houston or Seattle or New York City or wherever it may be, and figure out how we can take advantage of all of that and help everybody all the time.
Chris, while you've got the mic, let me ask you to follow up on something that you said a moment ago. OSTP has undertaken a number of initiatives focused on job creation. Startup America, it's working on US Ignite and so on and so forth. Could you spend a minute or two talking about OSTP's view of job creation and in a holistic sense what OSTP is working on, and perhaps also add how that fits into other administration initiatives on the issue of job creation?
I think I will immediately agree with Blair and the previous panel, is that in that, one of the number one drivers for what we do, and I think what almost everybody does, is try to figure out how to leverage resources. There just isn't enough. We've seen a dramatic changes in the amount of budget that is available, and it's not getting any better. So then the question is, if you don't have enough money to do what you want to do, need to do, but yet you have to do it, how do you do that? And I think the fundamental tenet of what OSTP, at least from the technology standpoint, is about, is simply this age-old idea of partnership. We often say that there's never been a better time to innovate with us. And it's this idea that we are trying to tap into the expertise of every sector of the economy because we understand that we don't have the answers. We don't have all of the solutions, nor should we. It's really about being transparent, accountable, transparent, participative, and collaborative, which is part of the whole open government initiative that I'll talk about later in this panel. But it really is, how do we open up and how do we start working with everybody, including small business, which is this whole Startup America activity, where the administration went across the country and interviewed over 1,000 entrepreneurs, small businesses, and other interested parties, and actually asked them what the federal government needed to be doing in order to create the opportunity for more jobs. And one would expect that there were quite a wide range of options or ideas or opinions that were created in that dialogue. But they do kind of come up to the same types of things, which is, you, the federal government, are hard to do business with, you never get back to us, and as a result, we feel a great amount of uncertainty, and we need to feel that you are there to help us. And so we are in the process now of kind of taking a very large document. By the way, if you're interested in getting that document, I'll be glad to share it with you. It's a fascinating document. And we're now translating that document into policy so that we can actually effect some changes in that. I'll just say from my own standpoint, and going back to my previous job as the Chief Information Officer at City and County of San Francisco, I believe strongly that one of the things that we need to be working on is improving the customer experience. And one of the ways that we can do that is through 311. And what I'm advocating, and actually was referenced in the jobs bill or the jobs announcement the president made, is more toward a national 311, where we rethink how we deliver our services and how we communicate with citizens, and actually create a two-way conversation, and actually create a dashboard, if you will, for every time you interact with the federal government, how you can know where your request for service is and be able to track it and know exactly whose desk your request is on. So, I mean, I'm a bit of far field, but that's one of the examples that we're doing, and I'll stop there.
Now, Jessica, according to the Fiber to the Home Council, some 52% of your grants went toward fiber to the home projects of one kind or another. And those of us who've been involved in such projects know that they offer a tremendous range of opportunities, but they also pose some significant challenges. Among the greatest of them would be to try to squeeze them into completion within the periods of time that we're talking about. Can you share with us what the RUS has learned in its experience in administering these grants, what kinds of problems you've come up with and how you've solved some of them?
Absolutely. It's a really good question, and I think that my colleagues at NTIA probably have would share some of the things I'm about to talk about regarding the implementation of the Recovery Act. The initiative across the government, as you all know, was operated within very specific time frames. All Recovery Act funding must be completely used by 2015, after which such time all funds under Recovery Act will expire. So we have very complicated, very integrated, high-capacity broadband facilities that are being built, designed, and constructed across the most rural, remote parts of the nation. This is no small undertaking, and it is a big business proposition. One of the great things about the Recovery Act is that it is truly, underlying everything you would, when you pick it all apart, it's ultimately a jobs initiative. So this is really, I think, what the President, put within the jobs bill framework, which is ultimately the 2012 budget, which is a huge emphasis on infrastructure. And the high-skilled construction, high-skilled engineering and accounting jobs that are required to build out these very complicated networks in the most rural parts of the United States. And when you talk about rural and when you talk about underserved, you're talking about expensive. The cost of deployment is so challenging. And one of the biggest challenges that we're facing that I think our colleagues on the Hill and I think the administration are very sensitive to is the environmental process. We have the National Historic Preservation Act, Section 106 of this, of the statute. We have the Endangered Species Act. We have a number of environmental requirements that must be adhered to prior to anybody breaking ground and boots on the ground. So, in addition to that, we all 300 projects within the BIP framework, as well as the BTOP framework, must also be reviewed. It's a mandatory requirement for every state historic preservation officer. Every SHPO in America in every state is appointed by their governor, and they have 30 days to review a federal construction project. So we have some SHPOs that, for a variety of reasons, will say, no, that doesn't work for us. So there's a lot of different pieces that I feel that the framers of the Recovery Act statute, H.R. 1, may not have fully been that cognizant of, because when you're dealing with interstate and intrastate high-capacity, expensive fiber-based assets, in addition to a variety of other technologies, building out a satellite network across a large region in the United States, building out a WiMAX network, you do need historic preservation and ESA compliance. So this is just one of the things that we've run into. In addition to that, we've run into, due to the earthquake in Japan, there is a shortage of fiber. Imports into the United States. So that is something that a lot of our borrowers that are building last mile assets to the Prem are being faced with, and that's becoming a bit of an issue for any fiber-based asset that's being built. But again, really, it's nonetheless a historic opportunity to really create some very high-skilled, high-wage jobs in these areas that are that require very specific skill sets that are sustainable jobs. There's also back-office jobs in building out these networks. And the communities that we're working with across America are thrilled because they want to attract these jobs into their areas. But nonetheless, this is just some of the challenges that that the Recovery Act projects are, some of them are running into. Hence, when we're asked about, you know, potential delays in getting boots on the ground, this is the reason.
Thank you.
Sam. Am I on? Paul? No? Okay. Now I'm on. Sam, let's talk community broadband. As you know, over the last several years, we've been quite successful in beating back efforts to pass new adverse legislation across the country. In fact, from 2005 until this last year, there were no significant successes in that. It hurt us in Congress, in fact, because members of Congress said, you don't need us, you're doing just fine in the states. And now, this year, we saw new barriers proposed in North Carolina, South Carolina, Arkansas, and Wisconsin. We're successful in South Carolina, unsuccessful in North Carolina, partially successful in Wisconsin, and unsuccessful in Arizona. In this new environment that we are operating in since the elections of 2010, we need new messaging. We expect to see another wave of bills introduced this year. From your perspective as an expert in public communications, what advice would you give us in returning to the record of success that we've had so far?
Well, I think there's a few. Am I enough?
Okay. There's a few things that I would think about. I think one thing is that there's a certain number of things that you just aren't going to be able to control about the political configuration in some of the states and localities, but mostly in the states where some of these laws might be put into place or are being advocated. I think, you know, it's become increasingly clear that there is an ideological layer or political element that just isn't going to be receptive to any kind of position that communities should be investing in this kind of infrastructure and owning it themselves. So that's one thing that's difficult to control. But there's a lot that I think people can control that they aren't necessarily controlling. So, you know, I believe that one of the reasons that you are seeing a lot of success by large incumbent providers in preempting municipal broadband is that in an economy as bad as this one, with states up against the wall the way that they are, it's very easy for legislators to just want to listen to business.
It just feels like a reliable voice. There's a lot of people who just feel like they don't have answers to what's going to work in the economy, so we should listen to large businesses. And it helps that a lot of these incumbent providers are able to invest an enormous number of resources in reaching these legislators. But I think it's pretty clear in a lot of the communities that the folks here work and live in, and also from some of the examples that we've heard from today and I'm sure in other days in this conference, that the reality is that the substance of some of these municipal projects really captures people's imaginations. I mean, I was floored to hear that a third of new jobs in Tennessee go to Chattanooga because of EPB. I mean, these are statistics that are, you know, are difficult for anybody from any industry to argue with, I think, you know, when they're true and when they're real and when you can lift them up. So I think the first thing is to lift up success in your own communities. I also think that we need to start lifting up the successes nationally around the country, because while on the one hand, I can understand why national policymakers are less receptive when they feel like the environment's been propitious for community broadband. On the other hand, I think this is a time, and, you know, I'd be curious what the other people on the panel think, when national legislators are looking for great examples of how this country is leaping forward and innovating. And so it's not just an issue of asking folks at the national level or at the state level to get out of your way. It's a question of asking them to be on your side, to be able to work with you to move a lot of these initiatives forward, to seed them where they're not moving forward and they would make sense. So I mean, I think that to me, that would be the operative objective.
We'll come back and dive a little bit deeper later on these issues. Dina, we've all been waiting. And I saved you for last on the first pass.
Don't put me on the spot or anything.
No, you're no more on the spot by my putting you there than you already were. Dina, please tell us all you can.
If you're referring to our broadband acceleration initiative. Well, first, you know, let me thank everybody who filed comments. You know, when I was thinking about what to say here, one thing I want to say is when you get 2,000 plus pages of comments, it's good to know that someone cares about what you're doing. And one thing about this NOI that we tried to communicate in the NOI, and I want to say again here today, is one of the big questions we really truly left open is, you know, is there a problem? If there is one, how big is it? What is it? What's the breadth? What's the nature of the problem? We tried not to go into this assuming there was a problem. We hear at the FCC, we hear complaints. That's what we do. People, you know, industry comes in and they tell us what's going wrong. And what's hard to do is find out, you know, an anecdote is not data. A one-off problem is not data. What we are trying to collect in this NOI is real information. We, you know, we took the advice from meetings we had with NATOA and the League of National League of Cities and Council of Mayors, or Conference of Mayors. You know, when we really asked, you know, industry, if you're going to make complaints, we want you to get specific. We want, you know, the states to be able to respond to these specific allegations. We want to get to the facts. And, you know, folks were specific. And we are waiting for, you know, the reply comments next week. We haven't reached any conclusions yet. I can say that it looks like from all of you who have not read all the pages of the comments, there's sort of some trends that are coming out. Four areas that seem to rise to the top in terms of where there might be some work to do, or we might be able to contribute something, and I'm not sure what form that will take, but it's in the area of best practices and procedures in distributed antenna systems, or DAS deployments. That's an issue that comes up a lot. That's a new technology. It's a new technology that's deployed in some cities, but not everywhere, and it raises a lot of questions when it's brought as a new technology to a city that hasn't seen it before. There may be an opportunity there for us to work with some of the associations on doing some education, really trying to think about what, and talk to folks and think about what would be useful. Another issue that comes up a lot, or came up a lot, is co-location and replacement technologies. I know Jane was on a panel earlier today on 4G. Yeah, and that's just, and first of all, I can't see what we're going to do with regard to this. I'm not a wireless person, you know, and we have an open court proceeding on this, but that's an issue. The other issue is really with regard to state and local rights of way. It seems to be identification of what we would categorize at this point as of outlier issues. Some stories, some recounting of experiences that, you know, sound problematic and may be something we want to look into, but it's not necessarily a pervasive nationwide problem. These may be some communities that are doing things that make it difficult for broadband build-out, and maybe we can look at ways to work with associations and local governments to try and facilitate better practices that could help with broadband build-up. The other issue that seems to come up a lot is stuff in our own backyard, federal practices and procedures, and that's, you know, the NEPA, the historic preservation, all of those issues. You know, we asked about the federal. We don't have jurisdiction to direct other federal agencies to do anything, but, you know, as an expert independent agency, I think we can bring something to the conversation about how to address these problems, and that's something we're looking to do as well as we examine the record. Right now, in terms of what steps we might be taking, what we're considering, and again, we're waiting for the record to close, is working on some sort of educational workshops where it seems like it might actually provide value. We are looking at whether there's some kind of recognition that can be given to communities that are doing really an outstanding job that can sort of both highlight best practices that communities can use if they want to bring build out or facilitate build out, and also to recognize those communities that do it in a way that helps them in their economic development.
Based on just the first round that you've gotten, have you got a sense of magnitude or scale of the breadth of some of these issues? For example, We've heard that there are some 700 or so complaints or specific complaints, and you will be getting responses to many of those. But even if all 700 were accurate, they would be a small fraction of the thousands of right-of-way transactions that occur every week, every month, and so on and so forth. So have you formulated, looking down on all this, a sense of how big an issue we're talking about?
And that's why I refer to these as outlier. Like when we're talking about individual cases of localities, really, mm-hmm. at least what we've seen, we would categorize it as outliers, not something that's widespread or you come mm-hmm. across in every city or any community. They are practices that are happening in some places that look like they merit further investigation into what's going on. I mean, and we also recognize and appreciate all the examples of, we recognize that there are issues that local communities are dealing with in build-out that are other issues than getting broadband out as quickly as possible. There are safety issues. There are aesthetic issues. There are things that are important to your constituencies, and you are protecting those interests. And some of the examples of, Fios build-out were, entertaining sort of as a counter to, I mean, not entertaining when they happened. I just meant, there's no completely clean hands here in what's going on, and we need to sort of work together to solve the problems and recognize, that inherently these kinds of things decisions are made at a local level, and there are balancing that we can't do from a national perspective. So
let me invite members of the audience to participate at this moment. It won't be as long because we need to be fair to other speakers, but let's take your questions for a few minutes on this issue while we're here. Thank you very much, by the way, Dina. Would anyone like to? Yes, go ahead, Joanne.
Thanks. My question's for Jessica. Can you talk a little bit about what the funding prospects are for some of the broadband programs that you do, and to the extent you're able to project whether there are funding concerns given the current funding environment in Washington, how you think it might impact the broadband programs, or maybe we're going to see increases?
Sure.
Just a second. Joanne, would you mind if we deferred that and had that as the first question following any follow-up that members of the audience might want to make with Dina on right-of-way issues?
Sure. I'm sorry, I didn't understand where we're supposed
to. I wasn't clear, but with that clarification, I'm inviting you specifically to address any questions you might have to Dina on right-of-way issues. This won't be your only opportunity. We'll get back to it a bit later, but let's see if any of you would like to do that. Okay. Go ahead, Jody.
What you mentioned in your opening, too, with the local government committee that's being formed. And I want to say it's so nice having you here and having Jane here from the Wireless Bureau and all of you here to be part of our conference. And I know that the NOI was very broad and probably involved many different bureaus. And our perception is that there's an industry committee that has a chance to put forth some recommendations, and we're just wondering on the timing if the local government committee will be able to have that same opportunity to weigh in before the final reports are made following the NOI proceeding.
Well, okay. So you're referring to the TAC, the Technical Advisory Council,
right.
Recommendation, broadband deployment working group recommendations.
And we sort of see the IAC as our equivalent to that,
right.
But ours isn't in place yet.
And I think some of that, unfortunately, is a timing issue, and that was when the rights of way was at issue, so the TAC was, There's a lot of legal factors that go into putting these groups together. I mean, the TAC is a FACA, the IAC is not a FACA, but I know that there were a lot of effort. But it has, and it's a FACA exception, and it has to be constructed in a particular way to have met that FACA exception, and I know there was a effort to have full representation of all the different categories of state, local, tribal representatives, and that contributed to it taking so long. That said, I'll get to the answer to your question, which is that we don't have, with this, we don't have a finite timeline for what's going to happen. This was, the nature of an NOI is different than an NPRM. What we're trying to do is collect information and determine what steps should be taken. I think that we are looking forward to the IAC being constituted and having a meeting and, you know, having this issue discussed. And I don't think that there's sort of a short timetable for taking particular actions. I think the chairman definitely wants to take actions where necessary. And I know one of the statements in the NOI gave some concern to folks, and that was that nothing, that by including this in an NOI does not mean, was sort of a caveat, that it doesn't mean we can't take action sooner. And what was behind that was really addressing concerns we were having from some quarters that by starting an NOI, which traditionally an NOI, a long comment period, a year later an NPRM, a long comment period, a year later an order, that it's sort of like a slow rolling step. And like effort, I mean, it's the way we work. But the nature of this NOI was with what we would, some things we might do may not take an NPRM in order to do, because what we may be talking about is doing, facilitating expositions and educational workshops, something that would be useful. So that was sort of the purpose of those statements was to let people know that we didn't mean that by issuing an NOI we were slow rolling this issue. It was not to mean we were going to jump the gun and act precipitously, and I think we absolutely want the input from the state and local governments, and we look forward to raising this issue there and getting the input from the state and local governments through that. And also, frankly, we were amazed at the level of participation by state and local governments in the NOI, and we really have been reading the comments very closely, and we're looking forward to reading them more. And, you know, we know this is a time when resources are tight all across the country, so not every state and local government can fly out and meet with us. We welcome meetings by phone. We if there are issues or things are out there, we are open to having conversations, and, you know, really we want an open dialogue with state and local governments and are interested in their input on these issues and hearing from you where we could be of use. We want to use our perspective to raise the profile of these issues to the extent it can help. That's really what our goal is. Does that help?
I think all of us are very pleased to hear that. Thank you very much.
Okay. Seeing no one else up for the time being, Jessica, let me remind our audience of the question Joanne asked you about financial resources that may be available through RUS, aside from the ones that are dedicated to the BIP program. I would like to expand on that question a little bit and ask you to always also talk about additional resources that RUS has to assist through technical support, through guidelines, through other materials that you've developed, encapsulating what lessons you've learned, and the floor is yours.
Sure, thank you. And Joanne, thank you for the question. Let me start by kind of reversing a little bit of this in a sort of jumping ahead and bringing it forward. The 2012 Farm Bill is upon us, and the Farm Bill is the statute that governs everything we do at the Rural Utility Service. It's our enabling statute that in which all of our loan and grant programs are authorized within. We may have a Farm Bill next year, we may not, but for local governments, I would argue for all of you to perhaps become active in the Farm Bill, because that is really a greenfield opportunity for enhancing the public-private partnership opportunities that we have to really leverage investment capital in your communities and expand the eligibility criteria of our programs to really enhance the types of investments that we can make in municipal projects more than we do today. Currently, all of the loan and grant programs across the RUS include municipal entities as those being eligible for programs. But we know how difficult it is for local communities to get past your bonding limitations and requirements. We understand that. And so with our 911 reg, we tried to come up with a creative mechanism to make it easier for local governments to utilize RUS to build out next generation interoperable broadband public safety systems. And we think this is a great opportunity to think about using it for next generation 911. But there's a lot of great programs, and I just find it so important for people to be aware of them and to constantly help you educate your constituencies about these programs. And I will also tell you that we have at RUS and rural development, which is the mission area that we're housed within, we have 47 state directors. These are senior political appointees in every state, and their job is to work directly with communities to work with all of you to come up with opportunities to finance projects. In every state that's represented here, you have a state director that manages numerous offices across that state that work directly with local communities to finance renewable energy projects, business projects, to help you start a co-op, whether it's a food co-op, a business co-op, a telephone co-op, an electric, a renewable co-op. We also have housing programs. All of these programs are administered across the state. At RUS, we have general field representatives that work for the telecommunications program and the electric loan program. These are business and industry loan specialists. Their job is to work directly with the communities and borrowers to explain to you how these programs work, how to apply for an RUS loan or grant, whether or not you're eligible, and I am happy to connect you with the GFRs in your state as well as your state directors. These are my colleagues, these are our counterparts in the states, and these are eyes and ears that can help you connect the dots. With respect to programs, we have the community facilities. The community facilities program is within the Rural Housing Service, but it's a great program, and it's outside the RUS purview, but it finances bricks and mortar facilities. It can cover the cost of a tower. It can cover the cost of the construction of a PSAP, a community center, a school. Any type of facility is eligible as long as it's 51% community owned. So this is a really neat vehicle for people here. Within the RUS, we have the Community Connect Grant Program. We just administered this, the 2011 awards we announced about 3 weeks ago for $13 million. Tiny, tiny program. But it has such a tremendous impact in supporting the infrastructure, the broadband infrastructure needs of the most remote, rural, economically distressed, persistent poverty areas in the United States. We did 18 awards across the nation, and I'm happy to forward you or send you a copy of all the awards that we made under 2011. I'll explain, basically, the Community Connect program provides grant funding for a community to start building capacity and build a broadband network. One of the stipulations of the program is that the entity must provide broadband free to the community for 2 years to help that community build capacity and ultimately develop a revenue model so that that business is self-sustaining. We have the Distance Learning Telemedicine Grant Program that provides grant funding. It's a $24 million grant program, again, very small. These programs could very well be cut or reduced, but there's such huge success in these programs in really meeting needs of providing advanced medical care to communities. And a lot of times it's leveraged with the FCC's telehealth pilot. It is leveraged with HHS HRSA health IT dollars. The RUS participates in the Health IT Task Force, and so we find that this is, you know, really our time to leverage these dollars as effectively as possible. We have the loan program that started in 1949. All plant must be broadband capable under the loan program. We have the broadband loan program that started under the 2002 Farm Bill, reauthorized in 2008. So these are just some of the programs that we have available, and I'm happy to explain how they work. We have eligibility criteria in terms of population density. Those benchmarks could very well change in the next Farm Bill depending on the changing demographics of rural communities.
When Jonathan was here last year, I think, or maybe it was the year before, he talked about RUS developing a guide program so that you would contact someone within the program and he or she would help guide you through the resources that may be appropriate. Does that program currently exist, and how would people find a guide if it did exist?
Let me tell you. So because we've been so busy trying to get Recovery Act dollars out the door as quickly as possible, the guide that I will just refer you to is our general field representatives. These are the people that will tell you how to apply for these programs. And if they can't answer it, you can call me, and I can help you.
Okay.
But essentially, there is no formal guide. Our state directors are essentially economic development specialists that will help you put together a project, help a rural community attract the kind of business opportunities that they so desperately need, leveraging the resources in farm and ranch land communities and areas that need broadband, need clean water, need electric service. There's so many parts of this nation that don't even have plumbing. And it's unfortunate, and there's no way you can really build and attract job opportunities in these areas without basic infrastructure, with broadband being the central pillar for that growth.
Sam, you wanted to comment?
I just wanted to jump in briefly, and I say this with this sort of the humility of sharing a panel with someone at USDA, but you know, I think your exhortation to become involved in the Farm Bill process is, I think, a great example of the kind of opportunity that I was trying to articulate when I spoke a minute ago, which is that, first of all, it's a really great opportunity to take the argument about municipal broadband to a different audience than is probably hearing about it all of the time. But second of all, I think there are other elements of sort of the Farm Bill debates, sort of in the past and now, that point to the potential here, which is, for example, I think that you're going to see in this Farm Bill, my prediction is that you're going to see extreme challenges for some of the largest and sort of the most iconic parts of the Farm Bill, so a lot of the direct payments, for example, that go to farmers in certain parts of the country. And I think as a result of that, you're going to see a lot of rethinking about what agricultural policy is supposed to be. And one group that has had a lot of success, or one constituency that's had a lot of success with some setbacks recently, is sort of the advanced biofuel constituency. And one of the reasons that they've had some success in this debate is because in a time when people are wondering whether we should be providing certain kinds of support to farmers and are beginning to question the role of sort of rural communities in America, advanced biofuel people were able to talk about, you know, the future, environmentally friendly fuels, opportunities to create job growth in challenged communities. And the truth is that, you know, a lot of those things are things that are true for municipal broadband. You can build smart grids. You can create jobs. I mean, I don't have to give you the laundry list of advantages, but I think taking those sorts of arguments to new audiences, and to audiences that, frankly, are much more regional than partisan in Congress around agricultural issues, is just exactly the kind of opportunity that I think you can use to sidestep a lot of the barriers that we're starting to see pop up in other places around this debate.
I will agree, and I will just say that one of the key arguments that has really resonated with so many policymakers is to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And that is an undisputable demand. And so if we can figure out a way to really develop a fuel source here in America that brings jobs and keeps them here and keeps all these jobs at home, and that is what resonates with everybody on that we work with. But it really resonates with all of your communities that want those jobs at home, that want to create homegrown businesses and sources of capital. And that's what the biofuels argument and sector has really, I think, generated a movement.
We have in the past used the argument more on the social grounds around broadband and fiber and whatnot. Are you suggesting that we should move away from those kinds of arguments and more towards jobs or harder types of things rather than softer kinds of things like economic development or community development?
I think they work in concert with each other. Community development is a critical pillar for job growth. It's the only way you can really get communities going. I visited Southern Utah. I was in Moab, Utah, 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, and this community, I don't know if anyone here is from Utah, but they have very inadequate broadband service. And there is a real community movement there to bring some kind of alternative source and even have a municipal system, a municipal broadband network there, because they are so unhappy with their service. And they came to me. And I said, you know, let's try to figure this out. So maybe we can all talk about this after, at the break or something. But, you know, these are the types of opportunities, like, to really get an REI to relocate there. They need high bandwidth capacity to attract more people that want to visit Arches National Park and do more, and then maybe grow throughout the entire area. So I don't know if I answered your question, Chris, but I think that community development and economic development are just two sides of the same coin.
And I would add to that that last April we had a full-day workshop on the relationship between broadband economic development and job creation. And the theme that emerged from that is that broadband is essential for the kinds of jobs that we want going forward, but it's insufficient. And what we require is a multidisciplinary approach, is building on the broadband lots of other things that it takes to ignite the job creation aspects of it. Broadband system is good, but it's not in itself enough. Chris, I have a question for you. I can't help but look over there and see you still as one of us, and I was wondering, what have you learned from your experience in Washington that you can share with us that we can benefit from?
I started out my career in Washington at a policy level and did something that I never thought I would do, which was work in local government, and kind of came to local government kicking and screaming, and spent 10 years here and had the best time of my life. And now I'm back in Washington and I'm back at the policy level. And I can safely say that there's a huge, huge difference between policy level and being in the city level. And it's the ability to actually truly innovate. It's the ability to actually design and implement creative projects that make a difference. And I miss that, to be honest. I miss that because we are so far removed. You know, in Washington, it truly is true that we talk a lot and we pontificate and we vision and we do all that kind of stuff. And after a while, you start believing what you're saying, and it kind of feeds on each other and everybody else. And pretty soon, you're convinced of the rightness of your beliefs without really having anything to back it up. And so I think that's why I will always keep Natoa near and dear in my heart, because this is where this is the Association of the Doers. This is where you get a good grasp of what's going on across the country. And I think these stories, and I just remember being with Joanne when we were visiting Blair in his office at FCC, and he was asking, you know, where are the stats? Where are the specific things that prove what you're saying? And at that point, we didn't have them. We have them now. And I think that's really what's important, is just creating the real life examples of what's going on. And going back to what you said, I just have a question to you. Thinking back to my old job, how do we find the right person to talk to? I mean, USDA is huge. We have you as a conduit, but there, how do we find the right people? How do we build those relationships? How do we make a difference with them?
Thank you, Chris. Well, USDA is so different from the other departments, and rural development in particular, primarily because we have this very extensive state and local government presence. And so all the communities here in this room, I think, have at one time interacted with rural development in some fashion, because there's such a deep investment presence that rural development has in every community. So what I'm trying to do, and what the administrator, my boss, Jonathan Adelstein, is trying to do, is really help a variety of stakeholders that we work with on the electric, telecommunications side, and local governments to essentially work in partnership with our state directors, our GFRs, and those of us in Washington, so you, when we go, you know who to talk to when we leave, because these are not permanent jobs. We are very fortunate to be in these positions this, the time that we are, but we do have a very extensive network, and I'm happy to, if people are not aware of how to tap the rural development state directors and your field offices and your GFRs, I am happy to show and introduce you to them. All the information is on our website, and we have events, including White House roundtables and White House business roundtable events on local business development. So if there's a way that you feel that we should do that better or differently, I'd like to know how to do that.
And just to continue, so back to you, Jessica. Mm-hmm. So in the jobs bill, you know there's money in there for the public safety wireless mm-hmm. network, and there's about $200 million to go into state and local governments to help the, build out the public safety network. Mm-hmm. Are you doing anything with that yet? Is there any?
That money doesn't come to, we don't administer that at RUS. We have, as I said, a provision in the 2008 Farm Bill that was never implemented. And so we wanted to make sure it was implemented before the next Farm Bill comes up, because we want to make sure all of our regs are done and completed and on the, you know, out for the public to use. So the loan program and the additional eligibility criteria that I just mentioned is within our existing infrastructure loan program. And we believe that, and our colleagues in the White House believe that it is a another tool in the toolbox to use for local governments and rural communities to use.
Okay, now I'm going to ask one last question, then turn it over to you. And this question is going to be directed primarily at Sam, but I would like to address the question to every one of you as well. And I'm going to take a risk here of telling a story that Milo told a couple of days ago, and if he tells the story tomorrow, I want you all to sit as though you hadn't heard it before. Milo was telling the story about dealing about a director of one of the utilities in Kansas City who's having a conversation with his son, and the utility director was hemming and hawing about how far to go in addressing Google's requirements for access to infrastructure, and his son said to him, "Dad, it's a gigabit. You got to do it." And he went on a bit more, and then the son said, "Dad, it's a gigabit. You got to do it." And then the story went on from there. To me, a light bulb went off, and pardon me if you heard me say this yesterday, a light bulb went off, and I connected it back to our fights for community broadband. And I realized that young people of America have a tremendous stake in the success of what we're trying to do, and we have not done a very good job of bringing them into the dialogue and giving them the respect and the voice that we should. So I will ask you, and I will challenge every one of you to think about this, and not just for community broadband, but for everything that we do as NATOA. How do we bring young people into the conversation that we're having about all of these issues that affect all of us so significantly, and certainly them, because it's their future and ours linked together that we need to be focusing on?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that we can do to bring young people into the conversation. I think one of the wonderful elements of this issue is that it's really about the ways that we're already bringing young people into a lot of conversations. The truth is that younger Americans are participating in public conversations in a way that they never have before, I think thanks to the internet. And they're also experimenting in ways that I think a lot of older Americans aren't, in some ways because they sort of are born into a world where they're fluent in this technology, and in part because they probably don't feel a lot of the old constraints. And I think that one of the most important things we can do is look at some of those conduits and think about how we can involve young people. I also think that, you know, one of the great opportunities for community broadband that cannot be missed is to think about ways to think bigger about what broadband can do, that gigabit networks, that extremely high-speed fiber networks, are able to do things that we can't even imagine yet. And I would say, first, that we should think about whether there are things that we can do with them that are going to be uniquely powerful and engaging for young people. But secondly, I think that we should think about ways that we can ask young people what we should be doing with these networks. And I think that it's interesting. Blair, in the previous panel, talked about decisions that France and England were making in early modern Europe about economic development and the ways that France got it right. And I think it's interesting because that was a time also when science was moving so quickly that societies did not really have an ability to make sense of what the opportunity was. And it actually took sort of a generation of their young thinkers, sort of the names that we now all have to read in school, like Descartes and Francis Bacon and all those people, who came up with the new ways of thinking. And these people, you know, invented not only modern modes of reason, but they also invented things like the Royal Academy and the National University and a lot of the anchor institute, the sort of the forerunners of the anchor institutions that we rely on now. And I think that we need to challenge our younger generation to think in exactly the same way. And I think that municipal broadband is exactly the kind of place that they want to do that, a place where they want to think anew about opportunities to build their own communities. I think that the very thing that's powerful about municipal broadband, which is that it's local communities deciding their own future, is the same thing that young generations want to be welcomed into, which is deciding their own future in an era when, frankly, a lot of people feel like they don't have a future. And I think a lot of younger people feel like they don't have a future. So I think my short answer to the question is, it's a gig. We've got to do it.
Okay. So the challenge is out there to you to think about this, and let's make this the year of young people and bring them into our conversation. Or let's put it this way. I feel that once they decide to join us in this conversation, they will take it from there, and we have a potential of going viral with our message if we can find the right ways to communicate. So, you know, please do think about how to do this. Communicate through Joanne, through me, through any of us. Let's do this year. All right, now let's have whatever questions you'd like to direct to any of us. There's a mic there, and is there still one in the back, or is there a floating one?
Hi. I'm Denise Brady, and Jessica, my question is for you. I called I was doing some research on trying to find broadband options for a little corner, the northwest corner of Marin County, about 30 miles from here. And there's some farms out there. And I got great service. The guy wasn't called a guide, but he was very, very helpful and gave me a lot of really good information and some ideas on what to pursue. But one of the things I found out was that this very rural, literally farms, are part of a zip code of Novato. And Novato is, I don't know, a 50,000 population, and it's well served with broadband. And because it's part of that zip code and it isn't a community that's defined on a map someplace, that they would not likely be eligible for the grant programs we were discussing. And my question is, all of the grants that you talked about today, do they all use that same kind of Rand McNally and zip code criteria to qualify to be eligible?
Thank you so much. The previous Farm Bill 2008 defined eligible communities for our loan programs as those that are in population density of 20,000 or less. That is the definition for communities that are eligible for our the bulk of our loan and our grant programs across the RUS. Our water programs are communities of 10,000 or less, so they're much smaller. Our business programs are 50,000 or less, and that is pursuant to the Census Bureau Census Tract data that we collect. Now, the decennial census is here, so we expect that that will yield dramatically different results. And we're hoping, obviously, in every audience that the administrator and I and all of rural development speaks to, we try to remind people to please, you know, make sure your voice is known and make sure that you are part of the census and that you have participated. The problem that you just raised is quite common. It's also anomalous in the sense that we have so many communities in pockets throughout America that are unserved and that are remote but are close, relatively close to an urbanized area. So this is a challenge that we expect probably will come up in the next Farm Bill in terms of how to define rural. This is an issue that came up recently at a hearing that my boss was at, and the agriculture committees in the House and Senate are looking at this very very deeply in terms of how to define rural. We have communities throughout New York State and townships and small hamlets across the Northeast where, and I know, you know, in the Sitoa Range community, you've got the same thing going on there too, where you have communities that are close to an urbanized area but are so remote. Parts of West Virginia are the same way, just right over a mountain pass. So this is an issue that came up in the Recovery Act. This is an issue that comes up with all of the programs, and in particular the telecommunications and broadband loan programs. So you're not alone.
Catherine.
Hi, Catherine Rice, president of Sitoa. Hello, Jessica. It's wonderful to see you again, and thank you for coming to Asheville 2 years ago and helping our conversation and blocking an anti-muni bill that year. This year we didn't have that kind of success, and I guess my question kind of ties into something that Jim just asked. The sponsor of the bill at one point stood up and said, look, wireless is going to make fiber obsolete in 5 years, so this is a risky business for cities to get into. The young people in the room sighed when they heard that said, because they knew that wireless was not going to make fiber obsolete. And so I'm wondering, and this sounds like a really naive question, but throughout these last couple of days, I've heard all these great stories about BIP and BTOP, all these wonderful things that are happening with the stimulus money, but out in America, people don't know. And I keep wondering if you guys can do ads, or can you communicate to the American public the wonderful things that our tax dollars are going for, because believe you me, it would really help back in the trenches, because it helps educate the generation that doesn't get it.
Thank you so much for your comments, and we agree that we need to tell our story all the time. We need to remind policymakers and our participants, our stakeholders, of the great work of the communities here in this room, and the those who were successful businesses that became eligible awardees under the Recovery Act program that are true business leaders in their communities and that are pioneers in a lot of communities. So it is so important. We travel every week. We need to come back to North Carolina, but our travel resources are what they are, so we try to do our best in putting information out on our blog on a regular basis. OSTP, the White House, has done a tremendous job in really telling the story of what's happening in rural America during the Rural Summit that took place this summer. The President's bus tour throughout the Midwest to really put the focus back on what's happening outside of Washington, D.C., and how Americans are doing neat things, and we need to talk about it nationally. So we should talk. We should continue this conversation. But as you can see here, there's a strong commitment on the part of our government, you know, on the federal side, to be here and to hear what you're thinking about and how to help you.
The naive part of my question is, can the federal government take out ads on television, for instance, to tell us all the great things that are going on, or are you prohibited from doing that?
I'll let Chris answer that.
And the answer is probably, I don't know. I think it is possible to do that. I mean, each agency has their own abilities and their own authorities to do certain things. and to tell their stories, and whether that includes the ability to buy ads on air or something like that. I honestly don't know. I'm guessing so. But I think it is, back to what Jessica just said, it is an interesting question about how we can work together with you in the community to tell stories, and it just is yelling in my own head, technology, technology, there's a way, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or whatever it is, that there's got to be a way to effectively tell it in a way that's cost effective, and I think those kinds of tools. And so I think through Natoa, let's have that conversation about how we can help you do that.
Could I just jump? I just wanted to say first, I completely agree with that. I think that there are a lot of ways now in the 21st century that you can tell your own stories, hopefully, in a little, and I know it's hard for a lot of you that you don't have the time or you don't have the resources to do that, so I really want to completely acknowledge that. The second thing I would say is, just do not be daunted about if you have the opportunity to talk to national policymakers, to set them straight about, first of all, what the limitations of some other options are, but also what the possibilities are for broadband. I mean, I think that there are few voices in national policymakers quite as powerful as the voices of local officials, people who are on the ground governing. I think that they understand that even in an elected administration that's not coming from a partisan place, that you have to deal with day-to-day realities that force you to rise above that. And I also think that at the end of the day, national politics in America remains very parochial, and a lot of legislators, maybe not always the ones that we're hearing from, but a lot of legislators really do care about what it's going to take for the communities within their districts and the places that they come from to succeed. So I know it sometimes feels like an uphill battle, but I certainly wouldn't give up in trying to reach a lot of these folks yourselves. You bring very powerful stories and a lot of credibility.
Okay, now some of our time is going to be reclaimed for awards, so let's be very quick. Last two questions, and let's keep our comments brief if we can.
My question is very brief and easy to answer, and this is for Jessica. Jessica, there are so many rural communities that are just hanging their heads because they weren't able to participate in the BIP program. And I think many of them are located next to cooperatives that might be able to reach out. But for the ones that aren't, one of the things that is really daunting for them, and I've seen this personally during the BIP program, is they might want to apply for some broadband loans, but they do not have the capacity to do the engineering and the planning that it takes to prepare the plans. And so in the Farm Bill, are there dollars for planning, or are there some in the related agencies like rural development or community facilities?
Absolutely. And you have a fantastic state director in North Carolina, Randy Gore, and our GFR in North Carolina is great, Pat Carey. So why don't we just talk about how we can connect you two on the phone and come up with some strategies to reach some of these areas, because North Carolina, there's still a lot of places that really need something.
In West Virginia, too.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Jerry, last question.
Sure. Hi, Chris. Hi, Jessica. Dina, my question is for you. My name is Jerry Lehrer. I'm with Best in Krieger, formerly Miller Van Eaton. We did the National Association's comments in the NOI, and I don't know if that's me. Did you hear Blair on the earlier panel?
I heard sort of part of what he said. I wasn't there from the beginning.
Yeah, I asked Blair, you know, what could we do better? How could we better advocate before the commission? And he gave this really interesting story that he was watching. I guess it was the I don't know if it was Colbert or the Daily Show, and he said that, you know, had the folks.
I did hear this.
Right. Well, I guess my question to you is the same thing happening at the commission? Is it that the industry keeps complaining they're being treated so poorly because every time they do, the commission goes back and tries to come up with another reason to tell us that we're wrong? Because, I mean, I'm sorry, I think you tried to be fair in your expression and description of the NOI, but I think you were ready to indict a number of communities. You did say that there are problems out there that need to be addressed, and
Are you saying in the NOI I said that, or just now?
When you were describing why the NOI was issued, I think you did make it pretty clear that you felt that there were problems out there that need to be addressed, and there are some outliers. And
I said that that's what's been identified, and we're looking for the responses. So I don't want to say we've reached conclusions on anything. There are problems that have been identified that we will be looking at further, as we're looking forward to the replies you know, that respond to those. I don't think this is a matter, you know, we specifically, and this was frankly at the request of the associations representing communities, asked in the NOI and emphasized to industry folks who were listening that we wanted specifics. Yeah. We wanted to name names because the complaint we heard is if you don't name names, we can't fight back. We can't set the record straight. So we said, by all means, name names. So that's what's going on right now is we're developing the record. I mean, we see industry more than we see you because they all have folks, Fred Reg people, who that's their job is to come in and see us on a variety of things. I think, you know, these days on build-out issues, you know, frankly, there's a lot more of this complaining going on the wireless side than on the wireline side. Although there is, I'm not saying there aren't wireline issues, there are definitely wireline issues, but it seems to be heard more over there, which is not, frankly, my particular area of expertise, so I don't want to speak to my opinion of the validity of any claims because that's what we're working through on the record right now. It's a big record, but there, you know, were statements made about, there are some, and I don't want to go down too far into the weeds, but, you know, when I asked her what are examples of the kinds of things that communities are doing that are problematic, and one example that was given to me is that a carrier talked about in some communities that hire consultants to do their, to sort of filter the application process, that there are incentives there because the consultants are paid for entirely by the applicant for the bills to get run up quite high, revisiting questions when there really should not be any question. And they gave the example of a case, I think it was in New York, where a court had actually ordered the refund, you know, refund that they found this consultant went too far. So that's an example where there's been an objective measure that perhaps some things aren't working well in this system, and maybe we could address what's... I don't know if we can help in that situation.
Well, actually, it's a wonderful example, and I think what we would like to highlight in that example is that there was actually judicial review that's already in place that was able to address that question, and the FCC didn't need to step in, that in fact, in the end, the provider, the operator, was protected.
And that can be the response to that. But that's an example of, and the providers are making case that these same consultants are working in many, many communities. And so, yeah. Frankly, at this point, I don't know what, if anything, we can do in that area. But that's just, you know, one of the situations that was highlighted in the record. So that's. And all I was trying to give a high-level categories of what we were hearing in the record. And my point in saying there are outliers is that what we haven't seen is a pervasive problem which is existing everywhere.
Great.
That's what did not come out of the record.
And I do really want to thank you and the commission for requiring that communities be named. We think that the reply round will be, we believe, very insightful for the commission when you hear the other side of the story.
And we are absolutely looking forward to seeing those replies. Thank you.
Let's give our speakers a great round of applause and thank you. Thank you all very much.
We're not done yet.
We have some an award to give out. Before we do that, I also want to thank our speakers, and especially Dina and Jane. I didn't get to thank you publicly for your panel this morning, but I will tell you that on behalf of NATOA, while we don't always agree, we really do appreciate that we have a seat at the table. The fact that you came all this way is very much appreciated. So I get to announce the President's Award for Chapter Excellence. And this is always a very difficult award. It's fun to present. It's difficult to come up with a winner each year because we have so many great chapters. But this year we are going to honor our Washington chapter, Watoa. So here's what I want to tell you about Watoa. I have watched them over the past few years in the educational programming that they do for their members, and it is really spectacular. Like I said, lots of our chapters do this, but Jeff, you guys do a really great job in a wide variety of ways for both your urban and your suburban and your rural members. But what I want to let everybody know, there is a the legislature in Washington asked the law school at University of Washington, and particularly the technology law clinic, public policy clinic at UW, to review telecom laws and policies in the state and to make recommendations to the legislature about any proposed changes in the law that might be helpful. And throughout that study over the past, it's been more than a year, I believe, but it's ongoing. You know, anytime there's a study going on about these issues, there's the potential for a lot of mischief to be done to the local government community. And Watoa has been very involved in advocacy in this process with the University of Washington group that's doing this work. And I just want to give you a couple of the issues that they have scored some pretty significant victories. As a direct result of the Watoa involvement, the university committee made a finding that local cable franchising is not a barrier to broadband deployment and recommended that the legislature leave local franchising alone in Washington. So that was pretty cool. They also recommended that public utility districts and municipalities be given express statutory authority to build, own, and operate broadband networks. So that's pretty cool also. And there are others, but those were the two big ones. And I'm very, very impressed, and I'm very happy to have one of our incoming board members for Natoa, Jeff Leaders, here to accept the award for Watoa.
Thank you. I'm very surprised that, you know, these things are unexpected and you just do things with passion in your heart for the various issues that come about. And on behalf of Mike Charbonneau, our president, and Chris Jeremio from King County, our vice president, and sneaky Tony Perez there, I actually left to get some caffeine, and he grabbed me out in the hall and said, you know, the board members need to be in here for support for this session. And I'm like, oh, okay, you know, so come back in. So anyways, I really appreciate it. And we have a lot of work to do, and we'll continue to do it. And I just encourage you all to continue to do the same. The issues seem to continue to mount, but at the same time, we get small victories here and there, and then we keep plugging along. So your residents look to you to continue to provide the services that you provide and expand on those services on a daily basis practically, and so thank you.
Okay, we have a break, and then we have another session, chapter meetings after that this afternoon, and then we'll see you tomorrow.